It's redicecreations.com, just as usual, headlines and news from around the world, including the free radio program. For you as a member, we have a new website, redicemembers.com. Go there directly to listen to new programs and watch our videos. Or simply click on members, as usual, from redicecreations.com. On the new members website, click into any program and log in when asked, download or stream. Any issues, please see our FAQ on redicemembers.com, where we have much more assistance and tips and tricks on how to use the new website. Today we're talking with Mark Grant about Macronicity, Micronicity, A Tale of Two Synchronicities. Mark holds a bachelor's degree in international studies with minors in economics, political science and sociology. Two of his main interests are mysticism and spirituality. He is the author of A Tale of Two Synchronicities. In his book, he subdivides synchronicity into two categories. The first, micronicity or micro-syncs, which are concerned with synchronicity that is observed at the personal level. And the other being macronicity, referring to syncs that are public in nature with meaningful coincidences. Mark Grant's work is a study of monumental moments based on the premise that certain epic events may be discreetly designed or synced. Generally, his focus is on the world of major sporting events. Mark will give examples of how epic events like the Super Bowl, Olympic Games, and the World Cup of Football may be subject to discrete and ongoing forms of extremely advanced intervention. Hi, Mark. Welcome to Red Ice Radio. Good to have you with us, and thank you for contacting us and wanting to get on the program. This is going to be a very, very interesting, a big topic with lots of new information as well. So first of all, welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me, Henrik, and thank you for having Red Ice Creation. It's a wonderful production that you've got going, and I really appreciate the effort that you make.
Thank you, Mark. Really appreciate that as well. This is a very interesting topic, one that fits very well, of course, into the Olympics theme that we've been following lately. We've been talking about synchronicity quite a bit on the program throughout the years, of course. This is taking things a bit step further, if you will, something you call macronicity. We're going to talk a little bit maybe more about this in the later on as well. But, of course, we don't want to leave anybody behind here. So let's give us a little on the background on the topic that we're going to talk about today, Mark, so people know kind of they get in the right headspace, I guess. So wherever you feel is pertinent to kind of get out to our audience here first, let's do that.
Okay, well, basically, the book that I've written, A Tale of Two Synchronicities, is the culmination of a five-year process that began when I was 44 years old. And I went to an elementary school reunion, of all things, which naturally caused me to take a look at my distant past. And in the course of doing that, at some point, I took a left turn and started to think about certain sacred memories or mystical memories. And as I looked in that direction, I knew that some of them contained very interesting elements of synchronicity. But in revisiting them a couple of decades later, I began to find that the evidence of synchronicity was much, much greater than I had previously anticipated or I had, you know, long since believed. And at some point early into that process, it occurred to me that the way that I was coming up with these associations was too remarkable to attribute to chance. So I began to suspect that my investigation was being guided to some extent. And not long after that, I began to notice that these syncs, as I call them, started to occur in wider settings. First, not only in relation to my daily routine, but in relation to certain civic events in the city of Vancouver, where I was living at the time. And then afterwards, in the summer of 2007, I decided to enter the world of film and television as an extra or background performer, and I was stunned to see the same thing happening as there as well. So this situation carried on for about a year and a half, and then finally, actually in the movie 2012, it all came to an end, my career as an extra, that is. I thought that I had the material for a book and began writing in 2009, the early part, but the sinks just kept piling on, and I felt like I had to keep shifting my outline, so I was really getting nowhere. But then in the fall of 2009, a couple of things came up, were on the horizon, that related to two of the mystical episodes that I had originally turned my attention to when this whole process started. Specifically, Super Bowl 44 and the Vancouver Olympics, there were reasons, which I can get into later, to suspect that those events actually might turn out to be synced. And as things turned out, they were not only highly synced, in my opinion, but it occurred, the way that that unfolded was on both the personal and the public level. In other words, certain events that occurred in Super Bowl 44 had a very strong personal meaning to me, and certain outcomes in the same game were clearly of more public relevance. A week later, the Vancouver games began, and the same thing happened there at the front end of the games and the back end of the games. So I was naturally very excited about this, and in hindsight, what I came to realize or conclude was that through this process of following the hypothesis that some of my thoughts were being guided, I was shown that they were in relation to civic events, the world of film and television, the largest sporting event on the American sporting calendar, a Winter Olympics, and then I began to think, well, there's also reasons to think that something might happen in relation to the 2010 World Cup. And that turned out to be true as well. So essentially what happened was I believe that I was pulled in a direction as a consequence of my own personal investigation that led me to see the same phenomenon occurring on much wider settings in full view of the public, whether they noticed it or not. And essentially, that was when I realized I had a book. And from this, I created a new taxonomy, if you will, regarding synchronicity without the taxes, where micronicity refers to the personal experience of synchronicity, and macronicity, or macro syncs, refer to group-level synchronicity. I've seen that now in relation to, well, my primary area of focus has been sports, but I've seen it in the world of film and television, as many people have. But as far as sports goes, the evidence that I have pertains to NFL football games, NHL hockey games, Winter Olympics, World Cups of soccer, Premier League football games. And the reason why I think this is so interesting is because these events are witnessed by typically tens, if not hundreds of millions of people.
Right.
And if I can make the case that something non-random is going on here, it is my hope that I will turn on the public in general to, you know, take a closer look at these public manifestations of synchronicity, because if my sample is indicative of anything, I suspect that it is indicative of the idea that this stuff is going on a lot more often than we think and has been going on a lot more often than we think. My investigation has made this point going back to the early part of the 20th century, but in my book, basically the design that I have uncovered goes back to 1966, July 30th, at Wembley Stadium in England, when England won the World Cup. And it works forward from there.
Very interesting. As you said, these are syncs, if you will, that are across the board. But in the book, you've looked specifically at sports, I think. It happens in civic events, film and television, Was it in 2010 then that you really began to see this in sports or look further into it?
Yes, exactly. It was in 2010, starting with the Super Bowl. I'll tell you, would you like me to tell you why I got interested in the Super Bowl?
That's always interesting, hearing that, yeah.
Okay, this will give you a flavor of what I'm talking about. I went to the University of Oregon as an undergraduate, and when I was 20 years old, just starting my sophomore year, I went through a very powerful spiritual phase. And for about 6 weeks or so, I really felt like there was a spiritual presence that was coming and going in my life. I should add that I never saw one, nor did I hear any voices, but it was just, I had a very strong sense of that. And during this time, I was seeing synchronicity all over the place and in many, many different, forms. Oftentimes, these syncs would seem to point to parables, you know, life lessons. Other times, it just seemed like I would have a thought and then somebody on the television would say exactly what I was thinking. I would think about a person and they would call. You know, these types of syncs are, as we know, quite common. But there was one thing that kept happening during this time that seemed really odd, that didn't really seem to fit in, but I couldn't ignore it because the volume of information was overwhelming. I kept seeing variations of the number 44 or 444. So, you know, naturally I wondered if I was looking for it and all of that, but at the end of the day, the information was just too overwhelming to attribute to chance, and I quickly accepted the fact that this was part of some agenda that I just simply didn't understand and had to accept. Now, there on my campus in Eugene, this is just the funniest thing. You know, when you start to see syncs happening from your telephone or your TV set, it becomes like your telephone or your TV set is talking to you in a way.
Right.
Now, obviously, we know that it's not, but some sort of association is being triggered. At some point early on in this experience, I had begun listening to a Pete Townshend album called Chinese Cowboys Have the Best Eyes. And for some reason, I got it in my head at the age of 20 that maybe Pete Townshend had experienced the same thing that I had at some point in his life. Because there was something about the way that his music resonated that gave me that feeling, right? And I knew it was kind of a wild idea, but, you know, I couldn't shake that feeling. About a week or so after this, maybe a couple of weeks, I don't know when, but I turned on the TV and I learned that The Who was actually going to be playing in Seattle at the Kingdome, the old stadium that's since been blown up. And when I learned about that, it occurred to me, you know, maybe I should go to the Who concert to see if I can make contact with Pete Townshend, and then maybe Pete Townshend will have a message for me. You know, that sort of
right.
And of course, I know it's a wild idea, but the only reason why I'm seriously considering it is because of the magnitude or the quality of the syncs that I have been experiencing since this whole phase started. Now, I'm a good student, and although I like The Who, I don't love them enough to go to a Who concert on any other terms, but when I saw this as possibly being a spiritual test, I decided that that was it. I was going to go to the Kingdome, and I was going to try to make my way to the front of the stage, and if God was with me, that would happen, and if Pete Townshend had a message for me, somehow or other, that would be communicated because the magic that I'm experiencing down here in Eugene is real, and there's no reason to think that it couldn't happen in Seattle at a rock concert with 55,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, and it was on the floor of the Kingdome just as T-Bone Burnett was winding down the opening set that I realized I had my crisis, so to speak, right? And it was like, okay, this stadium is a lot bigger than your apartment. Suddenly my dream seemed really small, and of course the whole idea of coming seemed ridiculous and fanciful. But nonetheless, as T-Bone Burnett wound down, it was time for me to make my move to complete my quest, right, and try to get to the front of the stage. So I will now fast forward to the end of that evening, where I have just concluded one of the most meaningful experiences of my life, walking out of the Kingdome without my windbreaker because it was ripped off me at some point during the concert, and one shoe, which is soaking wet, and I triumphantly make my way across the south parking lot, feeling completely and utterly validated by for having taken the chance of coming up here, to the coming up to Seattle. And I go home, back to my apartment, and the phase continues, lasts for maybe another few weeks, and then it ends. And because I have externalized this process, you know, and kind of attributed it to a spirit other than myself completely, when the effects kind of go away, I blame myself and go through, you know, a period of darkness where I feel like abandoned and all of that good stuff, and eventually recover, live my life. And at age 44, return to this as I start reflecting on my mystical past. So that's late 2006, early 2007. Fast forward to the fall of 2009. I'm now 3 years into this process of seeing design or sinks happen to an extraordinary degree. And I realize that Super Bowl 44 might have something on the plate, because it's not just Super Bowl 44, but it's coinciding with the 44th American presidency. So I'm thinking, okay, yeah, in a couple of months, you know, I bet you there could very well be some sort of macro sync occurring there. But I don't get too excited, because I know that I, you know, just because it might doesn't mean that it will.
Right.
Furthermore, I don't need another 44, because the 44s that I've seen since the fall of 82, when the experience that I just went through occurred, you know, it's not like I need to make one happen. So I'm a little bit aloof. Then a couple of weeks later, though, or sometime later on in that fall, I get really interested when I find out that The Who is going to be playing at halftime. So we have basically The Who occurring, playing in a 44-based football game that relates to the time when I first started noticing the number 44 and went to the most memorable rock concert of my life, which was all about The Who. So now I'm thinking, okay, is something going to happen? Well, basically two things did. There was, near the end of the game, a macro sync, which was extremely well appointed, which should be of interest to the group. But as far as the micro sync, the personal sync that occurred that related to me, that happened at the very end of the first half, immediately before The Who came on to perform at halftime, vis-a-vis a 44-yard field goal. So now this field goal was kicked by a guy named Garrett Hartley. And it just so happened, so I looked up Garrett Hartley because I've learned how to do these sorts of things, and or I've learned that it pays to do this type of stuff. And basically what happens is it turns out that Garrett Hartley played football for the University of Oklahoma, and in the year 2006, when I was 44 years old, and this I went to that elementary school reunion, actually exactly 2 weeks before, 2006 was his best season, and he only missed one field goal. He missed that field goal at the University of Oregon, which I was attending at the time when this whole phase began, and that field goal was a 44-yard attempt at the end of the game. So in other words, there's a path that proceeds from Super Bowl 44 that actually references, in very personally meaningful terms, the exact location of where I was as a student when this phase began, when I started to notice the number 44. Now, this particular field goal was of no consequence to the group. The way that the game ended, however, was, and it turns out that there are about a dozen meaningful associations, all of which can be easily verified when people understand what they are, which is in my book. that represent what I consider to be a vintage macro sink. So this basically kind of got the ball rolling, so to speak, where my personal path was very specifically addressed through a major sporting event, but also a sporting event that contained some very compelling macro or group level design. And this is what I began to think. I began to think that I was being pulled in the direction to look at certain specific events because they not only contained information that was relevant to me, but information that was extremely relevant to the book. And that's what got me looking at major sporting events in general.
I see. Now, there's more on 44 that ties into all of it. And if you want to continue on that thread, we can, Mark. But I did want to ask you a little bit about, the relationship to 89 as well. And again, just the overarching idea of why these numbers seem to be important, I guess, for the lack of a better word.
Okay, well, now, in 1982, when I first started noticing the number 44, I had no idea that other people were. It was 10 years before the Internet. I wasn't going to be telling a lot of people about what I was experiencing because I knew they wouldn't believe me. So life went on. Another big day that comes up in my book, a big spiritual day, was March 30th, 1986, which was Easter Sunday. And on that day, I had a religious experience in church, and a very sacred one. This would be 4 years after I originally noted the number 44. I find out later on that 44 days after that Easter was my birthday. 4,444 days after that Easter, I got married. 4,444 days after I got married was the 44th anniversary of England's victory at Wembley Stadium in 1966. The people will want to validate this. My birthday is May 13th, 1962. Easter Sunday, March 30th, 1986. England's World Cup victory, July 30th, 1966. It's all straight there. It's completely unambiguous, and I would like to see skeptics be able to reproduce these results consistently, which is what they would need to in order to validate the assumption that I'm actually just creating patterns here.
Right.
Okay, so I go through Super Bowl 44, and I find out that there is some very interesting personal and public design. On to the Olympics. I'm extremely interested about the Olympics because during the time that they are occurring in my hometown, I am due to be twice as old as I was on that Easter Sunday and 17,444 days old. Suffice it to say that that day was addressed in personal terms and in very meaningful terms to the Canadian public as well. And then at the very tail end of the games, the same thing happens on the day of the golden goal. Specifically, I can say this. The golden goal that was scored when Canada played the United States to conclude the entire Winter Olympics was scored at 7:40 of overtime. The address of the church where I had the religious experience is 7:40 View Street in Victoria. And this is just a tidbit of information that I could put out here, but there's so much of it that it's just over the top. Now, I published this book in June of this year, 2 weeks before the conclusion of the European Cup. I had mentioned that I thought that there might be a correlation between a kind of a sequence from Super Bowl 44 to the Winter Olympics to the 2010 World Cup. There is, but what I did not know was what I found out on July the 1st of this year when Spain won the European Cup. The most valuable player of the European Cup is a Spanish guy named Sergio Ramos. I looked Sergio Ramos up just out of curiosity and found out that he was also the most valuable player in the 2010 World Cup. what was striking about that was that Sergio Ramos was born on March the 30th, 1986, Easter Sunday, the very same day that I had this religious experience that was twice referenced during the Vancouver Olympics, and then referenced actually relationally, and we'll get into that later, through Garrett Hartley's field goal that in turn related to the Who concert. I know that this is a lot of information to put out there, but suffice it to say that, okay, in a couple of months after the World Cup in 2010, I'm driving around town in Vancouver listening to Coast to Coast. I hope it's okay to say Coast to Coast.
Oh, no problem. We've had one of the hosts from Coast on here, so no problem about that.
Well, it's a show. It is. Just like yours. I'm cruising around town listening to a Coast to Coast, and there's some guy, and he's talking, and it's like, okay, whatever, I'm only half listening. And he makes this remark that says, it would be just like I was in an Oregon USC football game and a UFO descended into the stadium, beamed me up for a year, and then brought me back and said, what have you learned? And I'm like, what? I went to the University of Oregon. That's kind of cool. And then the guy starts talking about the number 444. And he says that the number, it's a very powerful number, and that it is a number that apparently angels use to kind of hint to the public that they are guiding our lives or at work in our lives. So as soon as I got home, I had to listen and look this up, you know, because obviously it was extremely timely and very interesting. The gentleman's name turns out to be Nick Bunick. And when Nick Bunick wrote a book on the subject, I think it was called Messengers, and he said that when he wrote the book, he received 10,000 letters of people reporting individual examples of synchronicity, and that about half of them contained anecdotes that pertained to the number 44. Mm. So it was then that I realized that this wasn't just my thing, that this was a public phenomenon that people probably ought to, be aware of, you know, that this may be a designed shared experience. So just to make a long story short, I looked up at some point when I was thinking about this, I thought, you know, Nick mentioned a stadium. And so I wonder what's up with Autzen Stadium, because that's where the Oregon Ducks play. So I looked it up on Wikipedia. Now, the Ducks used to play at a field called Hayward, which is named after Bill Hayward, who was their iconic track coach for 44 years. When I looked up Autzen Stadium in the fall of 2010, I realized that the Oregon Ducks were entering their 44th season at Hayward Field, which turned out to be their most successful year so far. They wound up going all the way to the national championship, where they lost to a fine Auburn team on a very freak play that made me extremely annoyed, but they recovered. And then what was interesting about that was not only did they make it to the national championship for the first and only time in their 44th season playing out of Autzen, but 2 days after the national championship game, they opened up a new basketball arena to replace MacArthur Court, a.k.a. the Pit, where they had been playing for the last 7 decades. So you have this extremely probable set of associations based on stadiums in that instance. So it becomes not just a numbers thing, but the numbers are often tied to particular themes. And when you start to look in that direction, you find that the code is not only extremely timely, but actually very sophisticated.
It's very, very interesting listening to this. 44, we've heard from other people, there seem to be these kind of master numbers, if I can put it that way. 11 or 11-11, that's a big one. We've talked about that in the past with many people, but there's more. 33, 77, it seems to be these numbers that go together as well. And even as we talk here, looking further a little bit into it, in Gematria, in the Hebrew version of the Gematria, it's actually means I am the life in that, and there's tons of biblical references to 44 as well. What more can you say about 44, Mark?
There's a very interesting tie-in between the number 44 and the Fibonacci sequence. If you go to my webpage, macronicity.com, and click on the About tab, you will see in the left-hand column a subpage under the category of relational design called Unconventional. And I go into that on that page near the bottom. But suffice it to say that the Fibonacci sequence is based on the addition of two numbers starting with zero to produce a third. So we go with 0, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, and onward, as many of your listeners will already know, of course. It just so happens when you take the number 89, which is a Fibonacci number, and you take its inverse, 189, and express it in decimal form, the first six digits of this 44-digit sequence are the first six numbers of the Fibonacci spiral, 0.011235, et cetera, et cetera. It's important, I have found, when it comes to group-level coding, that the alleged code is placed prominently, and there can be no more prominent position in a sequence of digits than at the very front end. The fact that this is a six-digit sequence that produces the first six digits of the Fibonacci sequence occurs at a chance likelihood of exactly 1 in 1 million, which would make it about 1.5 times less likely than being dealt a royal flush with five cards in a poker game. Hmm. So there seems to be this symbiotic relationship between the number 89 and the number 44. Many of your readers will be aware of, or your listeners will be aware of, the Mayan long count calendar, and it is about 5,000 years old. In fact, according to Jeff Stray, G-E-O-F-F Stray, he's got a great resource site on the internet about Mayanism. The cycle is actually 5,125 years and 133 days. So you take 133 equals the sum of 44 plus 89. Going on a more narrow focus, returning to the sequence of Super Bowl 44, the Winter Olympics, and the World Cups, one of the instances of relational design, in my opinion, is based on that same number. There are exactly 44 plus 89 days from the day that the Winter Olympics concluded until the conclusion of the 2010 World Cup. Hmm. And there is a lot of symbolism within both games that kind of cross-reference each other to support the hypothesis that this may be a consequence of wider design.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, the wider design, and how you see this from your perspective, because there are a few different, outlooks we can have on this, Mark. Why don't you break these down for us, pertaining to, is it a coincidence? I pretty much can, we might be able to scratch that one, but, you know, it's still there. The wider design, where does that, you know, come from, and is there any other explanation for this?
Yeah, there's a, first of all, we have to be mindful, and I want to make this extremely clear, that I may, in fact, have found nothing more than really groovy patterns that are ultimately randomly generated. But then again, if a person's going to be dealt five royal flushes in a row at a card table, it's also theoretically possible that that could be due to chance as well. The body of work that I have considered may be design in whole, random in whole, or some combination. So I don't make any assertions that way. But when it comes to the idea of this being the result of me contriving patterns, the only way that that generalization can be validated is if, as I understand it anyway, if skeptics are able to produce comparable patterns consistently when presented with randomly generated events. In particular, we can go with Premier League goals in the case of man versus man, which I may get into later, but it's on my website if people care to take a look at it. Or in terms of relational design, which I'll get into shortly, then basically they're going to need to be able to show that most events most sets of events contain equally compelling patterns like the ones that I've produced in my book, and several of which can be found on my website. Now, okay, so there's the possibility that this may be random. Alternatively, there seem to be two major lines of interpretation. And I personally believe that it's most likely a combination of the two. One is the thought that we're dealing with some kind of mind-matter physics here, and that perhaps through a combination of heightened attention and, really powerful emotion, certain variables are kicked into play that produce these patterns, which speak to a kind of a physics that we don't fully understand, or we're probably just beginning to learn about. But as far as that goes, I would certainly encourage listeners who are not familiar with the work of Dr. Emoto and his work on water crystals to take a look, because it does suggest that may be a major step in this direction. And you can find references to Dr. Emoto, Emoto, online through a Google search easily. But essentially, what he claims to have been able to do is to influence the composition of water crystals through the projection of positive and negative thought. Now, the work needs to be, it's probably quite preliminary work. I mean, it needs to be peer-reviewed more than it has, but it certainly looks very promising, and I think that it like quantum mechanics, speaks to the mind-matter interpretation of events, or the way of explaining synchronicity and macro syncs. The alternative explanation, which is the one that I work with in my book primarily as a literary convenience, is that these syncs are primarily or exclusively the consequence of an extremely advanced designer who has decided to arbitrarily sign off on certain events and certain clusters of events as a means of discreetly hinting at its involvement in human affairs. This could be one particular individual. It could be any group of individuals. I don't bother trying to name the source in general, although it's kind of hard not to at times when it cuts into the spheres of religion. At the end of the day, that would be what I call the designer theory. And like I say, I work with that in my book, primarily because I figure, okay, this is where most people are at. If this ultimately is a byproduct of the collective consciousness or the individual that has trained their mind to look at things, and they generate it all on their own, then clearly at this point, because synchronicity has been around since the 1920s, this side of ourselves is so far removed from our current understanding of what our potential is that I think it's okay to call it a designer.
Well, if we, and we certainly don't have to spend that much time on it if you don't want to, but it's just, if we compare it to how the mainstream at this stage at least views this science, or so-called, rational scientific people that are absolutely, they're not convinced, they know that everything is completely meaningless, and life is just a fluke of random things being at the right time at the right place. Explain these things very simply. Of course, they call it pareidolia or apophenia, depending on how you want to see that. And they basically blame it on a side effect of the brain that it wants to try to find connection where there is none. But when the argumentation point is approached, it's very interesting how before anything has been decided, if you will, scientifically, it's assumed from their point of view, especially when we talk about apophenia, that everything basically is meaningless data. And they use this to explain away those people who have found connections with 9/11, for example, or even seeing UFOs or the phase on Mars, what have you. It's very dead at that point. It's like you can't even approach and go any further, because the belief system Mark is already there and in place, which basically states, no, there is no meaning in anything. Therefore, those who claim there is have just simply found a connection between them where there is none. So it's like a subject you can't even begin to approach when it comes to the mainstream, which is kind of a boring fact, I guess. Have you encountered anything of this, Mark, that this is trying to be, people try to explain this away?
Of course. Let's call ourselves scientists and make our decisions in advance before considering the evidence. Because in the case of synchronicity, that will relieve us of the burden of having to produce the same results consistently. So, you see, some people are going to make that decision without trying to defend anything because they've been conditioned to think along the lines of what mainstream academics and orthodox or materialist scientists anyway tell them is the prevailing, you know, what reality is all about. But macronicity is a different kind of creature. You see, when it comes to macrosyncs, I think that they are so compelling, and it's a superior medium for a number of reasons. For one, okay, when it comes to trying to justify the idea that there are subtle influences in the present based on ancient scriptures, for example, you run into all sorts of problems based on language interpretation, the authenticity of the text, and so on. But when it comes to macrosyncs that occur in front of 500 million people on a pitch in South Africa, or in front of 100 million people on a football game on February 7th, 2010, that information, those kinds of criticisms cannot be leveled. Then an intelligent discussion of the facts says, okay, if these are actually macro syncs, like this guy's claiming, or if they are actually just pattern creation, then the conventional scientists, the materialist scientists, ought to be able to consistently reproduce the results. In other words, what's going on here, as far as I'm concerned, is I don't give a shit what those people think at all. I really couldn't give a damn. Consistently produce the results. The onus is on you to actually walk your talk. Show me your stuff. It might be right. That's okay. And in the meanwhile, the rest of us can move forward. But here's why this becomes another reason why macrosyncs are a superior medium. When it comes to Red Eyes Creations and shows like Coast to Coast, they're great programs, but they tend to attract so-called fringe audiences. When mysticism starts to enter the realm of major sporting events, suddenly football fan, baseball fan, hockey fan has now got some information that they can sink their teeth into, which won't go away. So there's the potential here to tap into the collective consciousness, however awake or asleep it may be, and evolve this discussion, right? Because a lot of people, let's face it, that are interested in Premier League soccer are not going to be able to tell you what the Mayan long count is.
Right.
They might think it's an accounting method.
Usually, anyway. Yeah, right. You're right.
But as you get into this discussion, as it pertains to their favorite sporting heroes, again and again and again and again, now suddenly, at some point, the 100th monkey principle is going to kick in, and these people are going to say, you know what? These so-called skeptics really haven't walked their talk. They're throwing out some sort of ism at us that really has no substance to it. It might, but for the same reason I don't necessarily accept financial advice just because a guy's wearing a business suit, so ought I not to necessarily accept as gospel truth the opinions of a materialist scientist.
Yeah, it's the appeal to authority once more coming up through that. I mean, and just we're going to talk more about this in detail, of course, as well in the next hour, Mark, but just for the fun of it, let's talk just briefly about that Time Bridges page that you have about 9/11. Let's talk about that.
Okay, now, again, what I did the other day was I set up some sub-pages on my website So the listener will be able to follow along with what Henrik and I are discussing. And so if you go to macronicity.com and you click on the About button, you will see a subheading called Relational Design, e.g. Time Bridges. If you click on Conventional Time Bridges, you will see where we're at in terms of the point of discussion. Essentially, two things happened that are brought up on this particular subpage, and they concern the World Trade Center attacks. It just so happens that on the one-year anniversary of the World Trade Center attacks, the New York State Lottery, the three-ball lottery, had two draws as usual. And in the evening draws, the numbers came up 9, 1, and 1 in that particular order.
I mean, come on. What is that?
Statistically speaking, the odds, since there's two draws each day, the odds that this would occur on any given day are 1 in 500. However, this would not be news if it was December the 14th or August the 3rd. The only reason why this made the news, and it did, is because we are hardwired to notice anniversaries. So when we confine this fact to September 11th only, and the fact that we should expect to see this once every 500 times, what occurred on the one-year anniversary of the 9/11 attacks is something that we ought to expect to see once every 500 years, when we consider only September 11th. In other words, about 10 years, 20 years after Columbus sailed to the New World would be, if the lottery stretched out that long enough, that would be when we'd expect that. And then going forward, well, I guess we can expect the next 9/11 draw to occur on a September 11th if the state of New York is around then, to be around the year 2511.
2511, mm-hmm.
Okay, yep. So then we find out on the 10-year anniversary that the Belmont Racetrack in New York, they had their horse races as they always do, and the first three winners came up. The winner of the first race was horse number 9, followed by horse number 1 in the second race, and horse number 1 in the third race. Now, I'm not really much of a horse guy, but I think it's reasonable to say that there are usually around 10 horses in a horse race, okay? So don't get mad at me if it's a little bit different, but under those terms, we would expect to see the three horses come up 9/11 as they did once every 1,000 horse races. Confining it to September 11th, because again, this would not have been news had the horse races occurred on any other day of September other than September 11th, confining it to that particular date, we can expect to see the Belmont racetracks produce winners in that order about once a millennium.
Wow.
So now this is where it gets interesting and why I call these conventional time bridges. These two stories were newsworthy because we are hardwired to notice anniversaries.
Is that because it's like, sorry to interrupt, Mark, but is that because this is tied to, well, one spin around the sun, but it reflects our calendar consciousness? Much of humans' activity on this planet has, after all, been about marking time. You know, Stonehenge, for example, is a evidence for this. The calendar idea is incorporated into that, measuring what happens. It's connected to the cycle of life, of course, and even when humanity eventually got into to farming. Is that why you would say anniversaries are important, the solar consciousness, I guess, or is there any other reason in your view?
I got to be honest with you, Henrik. I really don't know. All I know is that we're big on anniversaries, and some anniversaries are cooler than others. I don't think that there would be many people that would be able to tell you what happened on their 23rd high school anniversary or their 14th. But the 10 years a biggie. One-year anniversaries are huge. Anniversaries in general are a big deal. I honestly don't know why. But when it comes to the fact that these are conventional associations that speak to us in a big way, this is what I've done. I say, okay, if this is actually a designed method where some advanced intelligence is essentially speaking to us through anniversaries, then why don't we consider these anniversaries to be conventional time bridges? In other words, they're conventional in the sense that most people will have to agree, yeah, I think this guy's crazy, but he is right about this being a one-year anniversary. I know people think that way, and 10 years too, and oh my God, my wedding anniversary is coming up next week. I'm glad I listened to this guy for at least this long. You know, it just so happens that when you start to consider this to be a conventional time bridge and you look at other macro synced events, you start to see evidence of unconventional time bridges, which we can get into in a minute. But there's one thing that the 9/11 syncs raise, which is worth mentioning at this point because it addresses the materialist random rebuttal, if you'll call it that.
Mm-hmm.
The article that I provided on the Belmont racetracks was from the Daily Mail in London. And in the message section, there was a guy who called himself Common Sense Connor, and he said, to be fair, you know, you can pull today, you can pull up 911s anywhere, you know, and he's thinking like license plates, you know, restaurant receipts and all of that. The problem with that discussion, and the reason why it's really important to understand why that argument fails, is because macro syncs speak to groups. Therefore, the 9/11, in order to qualify as a valid macro sync, must be prominent. The New York State Lottery qualifies as a prominent macro sync because it occurred in the state of New York. This would not have been news had the 9/11 draw occurred in Oslo.
And why is that? Explain that a little bit.
Because it's a geographical measure of prominence in this particular case.
So it's tied to the area, the city, it relates to the name,
right,
and the event itself happened there, so therefore that's the epicenter of where the sink is prominent. That's what you're saying.
Precisely. Likewise with the Belmont racetracks, not only did they, the race results, not only did they occur on this very choice 10-year anniversary, but this would not have been news had the races occurred in Ecuador or Guam. Instead, the races occurred in what was the staging area for the rescue operations of the World Trade Center attacks. So again, this particular racetrack enjoys a level of prominence that all of these other associations do not. If I can make a quick poker analogy,
mm-hmm.
Henrik?
Sure.
Okay, let's assume that we're dealing with a materialist skeptic who has absolutely no clue whatsoever about the game of poker. And we're sitting down at the table, and you get dealt a royal flush, and everybody except this guy is really impressed. And we go on to explain, hey, listen, there's 2.6 million possible hands that can be dealt in poker, but there's only four ways that you can get a royal flush. This is something that we would expect to see once every 650,000 times a hand is dealt. And this guy, the materialist scientist, who's holding a two of clubs, a three of hearts, a nine of diamonds, a jack of spades, and a seven of whatever, who cares, points out that his hand can only be replicated once. Yet it's worthless in the game of poker. This is because poker constrains the rules of what qualifies as something that is eligibly improbable, right?
Mm-hmm.
A worthless hand in poker is actually four times easier, harder to get than a royal flush, since there's four combinations of that. But the rules of poker constrain what is acceptably improbable. Macro syncs constrain what is acceptably improbable through the way they must be tied to something that is prominently associated with the event. It doesn't matter if a 9/11 occurred on the one-year anniversary in Guam. It doesn't matter if Common Sense Connor got a receipt for $9.11. That might be of personal interest to him.
Right.
The group has to agree that this is prominent.
And this is a lottery. It's public or civic, as you said. It goes out to a lot of people. It's monitored. A lot of people participating in it as well in New York. Yeah.
Exactly. And this is what really constrains the discussion in terms of falsifying the evidence for synchronicity, especially at the macro level. At the micro or personal level, there's so many things that can be of particular interest to the individual that the group will say, okay, whatever, dude, that's your trip. Such as the way Garrett Hartley kicked a 44-yard field goal immediately before halftime when the Who played at Super Bowl 44. That was a hugely big deal to me. But you ask anybody else watching that game, they'll say, well, yeah, that was your trip. You know, more power to you if they're nice. But it did not have any consequence on the outcome of the game. Something else did, though, and football fan will certainly agree if they read my book and find it. Just as hockey fan or Olympic fan will understand exactly why the information surrounding the golden goal that concluded the Winter Olympics is so compelling, just as the goal that ended the recent Premier League season is compelling. Those, by definition, are prominent because they defined the outcome of an entire season in the case of the Premier League and an entire Olympiad in the case of the Vancouver Games. It's not a negotiable point. Prominence matters a lot when it comes to macronicity.
Now, there is so much more to talk about this, Mark. We're going to get into this a little bit more in the second hour. Why don't we wrap things up here for the first, talk a little bit more about where people can go to pick up a copy of the book. There's just so many more interesting points in this. We haven't even begun scraping the surface of this yet. We're going to continue and carrying on through the links that we have linked up as well on Red Eyes Creations. But your website, first of all, macronicity.com. Can we go there to pick up a copy of your book, Mark?
Yes. Yeah, you'll see it on the main page, a reference to the book and to Kindle. And when this show airs, I'm going to reduce the price of the Kindle version as much as I can and offer some sort of discount on the book for 2 weeks from the time that the show airs. You can also read about macro syncs on my blog. I would invite people to contribute to this because this is really just a pioneering work. I assume that there's a lot of people out there that are a lot brighter than I am, that know a lot more about a lot of other subjects. We're not talking just about sports here. So if you find what you consider to be a high-quality macro sync in relation to whatever it is that you're interested in that applies to a group, if you'd like to let me know, I'll take a look at it. I may post it on the blog. You can follow me on Twitter. If you'd like to know when I uncover some more information, I'll be happy to share it with you that way. And there's one other thing that I thought that I would add on my page here, which is really just getting going, and that's my recommended link. I've been studying alternative subjects now for, you know, I'd say close to 15 or 20 years. And some of the websites that I've found and some of the information really stands out in a field that is often polluted with a lot of hyperbole and noise. And so if you want to take a look at the recommended links, it's there to help expedite your learning. There's some of what I consider to be the best of the best links there. So that's it, macronicity.com.
Really good stuff. A tale of two synchronicities, and again, the website, macronicity.com, links up on the website. We're going to carry on here in the next hour, and again, very interesting stuff. Haven't even begun here, it feels like. Stay with us, Mark. We'll be right back with more.
Just a little bit south of Saskatoon, take my guitar for boarding room. Met a little girl, her name was June, a little bit south of Saskatoon. Me and Junie maybe got on fine, till I had to move on up the line. Promised that girl I'd be back soon, a little bit south of went up to Nome to see the sights. Had he in to watch the northern lights. But I had my mind on my sweet June, a little bit south of Saskatoon. So I caught a freight and headed back, traveling down that railroad track. Kept thinking of my honeymoon, a little bit south of Saskatoon. Me and Junie Mae got a little house, got a piece of ground and a few milk cows. Gonna get a young'un soon, a little bit south of Saskatoon. In the winter time when we can't farm, me and Junie Mae sit arm in arm. By big old fire and honeymoon, a little bit south of Saskatoon.
We are going to continue with Mark Grant in the second hour, talking about designer theory, relation design, sound bridges, conventional and unconventional cues, and mind matter theory. So if you want to tune in, go to redicemembers.com and click on subscribe to sign up for a membership and enjoy the new members website. If you're a member listening through redicecreations.com, remember that we have both Hour 1 and Hour 2, or however many parts the program is, available for you on redicemembers.com. So go there, click into any program to log in and listen. If you previously used our RSS feeds, we of course, as usual, have the free feed on redicecreations.com. The new members' feeds are divided by year, and they go all the way back to 2006. And of course, we have a feed for all the latest programs in their entirety also. You can now comment on any of our programs, share your thoughts with fellow Red Ice members. If you have any questions, please go to redicemembers.com, where you can read more about becoming a member. And of course, if you have any questions, click into our FAQ to read more. We'll return with more radio shortly. Next, we'll have Freeman and Jamie with us. Lana will be joining us in the studio as well. After this, we have Randall Carlson, Charles Upton, and Santos Bonacci coming on the program, to name a few. But right now, we'll proceed on redicemembers.com, Hour 2, with Mark Grant.